the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello again and welcome to the show. Coming up, local bananas may soon no longer be sold in some of the big supermarkets. We'll hear about that story shortly. Also, beekeepers pleading for financial help from the government to keep their bees pollinating.
It's up to 35 to 40% of commercial beekeepers are losing faith in the industry and thinking about leaving the industry in 2 years' time. We have already seen some commercial operators leave, some of them being generational beekeepers. And once we lose those generational beekeepers, we're losing the knowledge that gets passed down. Beekeeping's not something you can learn overnight. It's years of working and understanding how it all, the floral and chasing different flora and fauna.
We'll also hear about the continued spread. Seems to be ramping up bird flu in more places. We'll hear the latest and what should happen in terms of vaccination, particularly in the poultry and egg industry as well. That's all coming up on the program. But first today, it was once the banana capital of Australia, but Coles stores on the Coffs Coast won't be stocking locally grown bananas much longer. The supermarket giant is ending its local supply arrangement for bananas, cucumbers and pumpkins and will instead source produce through Coles' national distribution system. Farmers say they're worried the move puts the future of the local industry at risk. Lauren Bohane has more.
When the community goes in to buy a banana in Coffs Harbour, given it was the banana capital of Australia and the big bananas here, there would be a perception that they're actually buying a Coffs Harbour banana.
For the past three decades, Mick Gentle has been growing bananas at Bonville on the Coffs Coast. But a decision by supermarket giant Coles to end its local supply arrangement for bananas, cucumbers and pumpkins has left him questioning the future of the local industry.
I think it's a real kick in the guts for us growers here in Coffs Harbour. I'm third generation. I've got a son who will be directly affected from this decision of Coles to not take local fruit. And he's also got two boys which could potentially will love to grow bananas alongside their dad. So there's six generations there possibly if he can continue growing bananas.
Growers in the region were selling to a wholesaler who supplied local Coles stores. However, Coles has now made the decision to end its arrangement with that wholesaler. New South Wales Farmers says up to 40 farming families will be impacted by the move, which it estimates could have a flow-on economic impact of $80 to $20 million. Coffs Harbour Branch spokesperson and banana and cucumber grower Paul Shoker says it's created a feeling of uncertainty in the local industry.
Supermarket trade is the bread and butter that keeps local farmers around. Those two supermarkets combined nationally sell 70%. Of the fresh produce market. And so if you haven't got access to half of that 70%, it just means that basically businesses contract locally, businesses have uncertainty. And over those last 12 months, there's been back and forth about negotiation to see if, we can change things. But they've made the decision. And it seems like perhaps October sometime is when that relationship will cease. And we're still calling upon them to look at that decision again and possibly reverse it because the overwhelming feedback is the quality of the local bananas are better. Locals want to eat local produce. The example is the local Coles store for us is 6 kilometres away from our farm. And now the bananas will be coming from over 2,000 kilometres away to service that store. So I don't see how that's a more efficient process. Fortunately, there is extra capacity at the other major supermarket. There's all a bit of uncertainty. You know, we were planning ahead to, put more acreage in. And that's sort of on a bit of hold now because it's potentially 30 to 40% of the local consumption is through Coles. So that's a big hit to our industry. And it's not something that we can sort of, create a new market over 12 months, really. It's something that you probably need at least 5 years to develop.
In a statement, Coles says the decision is part of a broader change to Coles' fresh produce supply model, and as part of that change, the supermarket is transitioning away from direct-to-store produce arrangements and towards a more consistent operating model across the store network. It says it recognises that this will impact some supplier arrangements, and the decision was not taken lightly. Growers who were supplying Coles through the local wholesaler now have no contract to supply fresh produce to Coles stores.
Look, if they can't supply Coles here, I suppose the growers here will have to find another market, or like another market in Coles, but this area doesn't have the population to support all of them. So I suppose the growers then will be looking for to then go back to the Sydney market or the main market stream to sell their produce. So it just doesn't make sense when we look at carbon footprint. The growers and people are encouraged to consider the environment these days. So when we look at the distance for the fruit to travel from farm to local store compared to Queensland to local store, or even then if we go towards the procedure that we may have to take from Coffs Harbour to the central markets and then to a local store, it just doesn't make sense. Like the food mileage and the impact that we're going to make on the environment through carbon emissions and, look, just extra diesel costs, it just doesn't make sense.
As a fourth-generation banana grower in the region, Mick Gentle says he's now questioning the future of the Coffs banana industry for the first time.
My mind struggles with it, actually, to think that banana Coffs Harbour might be without bananas one day. If I was to look at Australia and think Australia got rid of their koala or their kangaroo, well, far out. That's the same impact it has on Coffs. It's renowned for the bananas. Taking the banana out of Coffs Harbour, just very strange thought to have.
Secretary Treasurer of the Coffs Harbour District Banana Growers Association, Mick Gentle, ending that report from Lauren Bohane. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 12 minutes past 12.
The New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
You might want to comment on the banana story, 0467 922 684, the banana capital of Australia. Can't get soon, won't be able to buy bananas in the Coles store there, according to Coles. Tony's texted in saying, did anyone bother to ask Coles why? We did. We did ask Coles why, and all we got was a statement. We tried to get some interviews with them about it as well. They said that they were going to a national distribution system. It's 13 minutes past 12 here on the New South Wales Country Hour. 0467 922 684. Getting some rainfall figures as well. Albury, John's had 17 millimetres of soaking rain and maybe more to come, says John. You can send us a text about any of the stories you hear on the program here on the Country Hour. Well, the devastating H5 variant of avian influenza marked a bit of a grim milestone over the weekend, a first confirmed case of transmission between bird and mammal species being recorded. Experts saying the worst is yet to come. A long-nosed fur seal confirmed to have died of the disease in South Australia. Several other cases are being investigated near Kangaroo Island. Another confirmed case today in a bird in Queensland. Environment Minister Murray Watt says the country needs to be realistic about the impact this illness will have on native wildlife and conceded we're likely to see mass mortalities of birds and mammals. Bird flu is thought to be spreading rapidly amongst migratory and domestic birds in Australia, and the virus, of course, can live for significant periods of time outside of a host animal. Michael Ward is the Chair of Veterinary Public Health at the Sydney Veterinary Clinic and is at the University of Sydney as well. He says the bird flu is now spreading rapidly.
That's true. Well, fair to say that it's definitely here and it's here to stay. And it's really evolving the way we've seen it overseas, where you get these isolated cases, which we've seen, and then we've gone through that stage and now these mass mortality events and the spread. So it's sort of very much playing the way it has elsewhere, particularly that spillover now into sea mammals. So that's sort of the next stage in this evolution.
Looking at the playbook then overseas, what can we expect next?
Well, we've seen that, moving into sea mammals, causing problems there, potentially sort of threatening some of these wildlife species. Seals, not so much. They're not endangered, really, in most places. Sea lions, particularly. I think there's great concern. There's a couple of colonies in South Australia, if I'm correct, somewhere around, I don't know, if they're on Kangaroo Island. They've been threatened for a while by, different things. So avian influenza is sort of, the last straw in terms of those small populations. If they get hit by something that, wipes out 50% of the population, it's very difficult for those populations to survive.
So it could be an extinction event for them.
That's right, yeah. It's very possible in those sort of circumstances, yeah.
And that's why they're vaccinating fairy penguins outside of Melbourne.
That's right, and I think it's interesting. I'm not sure the actual motivation. I guess they're sort of iconic, great sort of tourist value. And also, my understanding is they're not that difficult to vaccinate. Vaccinating any wildlife population is really difficult. In this case, I guess, they don't run too fast. They're easy to capture. So that's probably a good situation. But in other situations, it would be really difficult, if not impossible, to get vaccine into wild populations.
And when would we start thinking about vaccinating commercial poultry?
Yeah, that's a big decision. One of the driving sort of reasons for not vaccinating is because of, markets and trade. Once you start vaccinating, then the whole industry is, said to be vaccinated. Certain countries won't accept your poultry products, although with Australia, we don't export that much. So
Papua New Guinea, I think.
Yeah, that's right. So it's not like, if we're vaccinating cattle, for example. So that's not such a concern, but we still don't like to do that. And there's also then the consumer preferences and that whole debate about, vaccinating animals. I do see there's quite a bit of stuff on the internet about, the anti-vax sort of view about, putting vaccines into what we're going to eat. So there's all sort of all those sorts of things that the authorities would be considering. It's very interesting, when they'd actually do that and what sort of stockpiles we'd have. That's the other issue.
Overseas, how long does it take before this virus, H5N1, gets into commercial poultry and egg production areas?
Yeah, it's highly variable, I think. We've had the benefit of seeing this coming for, 4 to 5 years now. We never thought it would come, through this southern route, but it has. We've had plenty of time, with biosecurity to sort of ramp that up. We might be better off than other countries in delaying it and even stopping it. It would seem, if it has become endemic, it would seem unlikely that we can stop it forever. So, eventually you would think it would start to get into the poultry industry. As I've said before, one of the sort of Achilles heel really is backyard poultry production, which doesn't have the resources, doesn't have the biosecurity. Every backyard, operation is different. So that could be where it comes in, and then it might be more likely to go from backyard to commercial. Although you would think the biosecurity would also be good at stopping that. But, yeah, not sure. Yeah, I'm not going to predict that one. I don't know how long that's going to take.
It's said to not really be probably going to be an issue for dairy cattle here in Australia. But I don't know what they're basing that on.
Yeah, there was a risk assessment done. I think it was 2 years ago or last year. Sort of based on the North American experience, they concluded that there was low risk, but when you looked at all the different animal industry sectors, dairy was still the highest. Even though it was low, the rest were sort of negligible, but the dairy industry was low. So it's higher than all the other industries put together.
But not as high as poultry, not as high as egg production, but it's still a risk.
Yes, yeah, that's right, yeah. This was, mammal spillover, so, sheep and cattle and dairy and so on, and pigs. That was sort of really based on the North American experience, which, again, it's very unusual. I don't think they've ever really figured out exactly why this happened. They do have very big dairy production sites there, and that they might be, attracting wild birds more, or there might be some sort of management factor. So this risk assessment said, well, we're not the same as that. So it's not as high risk as in North America, but it's still there is still a risk there in that industry particularly.
We're also hearing wildlife experts saying that we need to spend more on, habitat and prevention in the wild. $100 million a year for the next few years or so. Does that dovetail in with what you're thinking?
It does sort of. You know, really, there's not a lot you can do in wildlife, so it's sort of almost an indirect response, as in
they say, making them healthy as you can, and have water habitat and things.
Yep. Yeah, so it's sort of resilience. If you have a healthy wildlife population, they probably can survive this major impact of avian influenza. When the sort of populations are sort of on the edge anyway, disease can just push them over the edge. So that's sort of the argument there. You know, if you get rid of the feral cats and whatever else is affecting those populations, they'll be stronger and they'll be able to withstand this avian influenza better.
Should just get rid of feral cats anyway.
Well, that's it. I mean,
feral pigs.
Do you need any other reason? I mean, it's nice that you can do disease, and if there was money, I mean, I guess it does highlight that we don't really have much response when it comes to wildlife, based on overseas, based on here. There's not a lot you can do to sort of prevent this disease.
Professor Michael Ward is the Chair of Veterinary Public Health at the Sydney Veterinary Clinic and also at the University of Adelaide. It's 21 minutes past 12. Getting some texts in. Jeff says they've had 37 millimetres at Cootamundra to midday, still raining lightly. Thumbs up, he says. Steady rain, says Dave at Trundle. Most of the morning was 6 millimetres so far. And someone's texted in to remind us, and this is a good reminder, actually, don't forget, not so many years ago, they wanted to import bananas from the Philippines, yet another dictatorial move from the supermarket monopoly and their bully boy tactics. Shame on you, Coles, says Dave. And, yes, there's a whole bunch of other texts there. I'll get to them a little bit later on. As well, someone else saying Coles makes record profits and then knocks down the local producers, says Don at Kiama. Shame on them, says Don. It's 22 past 12.
Every community has stories worth sharing. ABC Your Say is your chance to join the conversation. Tell us what's on your mind. Visit abc.net.au/yoursay.
Big polluters and foreign investors are buying farms around the country to set up forestry or carbon storage projects to offset their emissions, and they're not the only ones chasing farmland. Nature repair schemes are paying landholders to store carbon and protect biodiversity, while the federal government has set a target to protect 30% of the Australian landmass for conservation by 2030, as David Claughton reports.
Ben Nichols in Tottenham in central New South Wales is deeply concerned about the impacts of these schemes on his region.
So at the moment we've lost 10,000 hectares in our district. We've lost five families, that's three or four or five kids at the school. We lose a teacher, we lose a nurse. One farm might be spending for inputs on that farm $1 million. Most of that would go back through our rural services suppliers. So they're not getting the business. The pub doesn't get the business at all. It's a huge effect.
Ben Nichols says the growth in offset projects is rapidly increasing and includes high-value farmland that's been laser-levelled for cropping. He says these companies can outbid local farmers for land, have little interest in fire control or pest management, and they're looking for another 100,000 hectares, which will tie up the land for 100 years.
There's only 15% of New South Wales that's actually arable that you can grow crop on to have your wheat mix, to have your rolled oats, to have all those things, to have your barley for your beer, and we're going to chew it up with trees.
It's hard to get figures on the amount of ag land taken up by these schemes, but Dr. Samantha Andrews did a study on threatened species habitat and carbon storage schemes for the Hawkesbury Institute for the Environment at the Western Sydney University. She looked at property sales in Australia over 3 years up until 2024 and says the amount of ag land affected by threatened species and carbon projects was small at that stage.
Only about 2.4% of carbon farming land covers areas that were previously modified ag lands, and that current carbon farming projects cover less than 1% of the land that was previously used for modified ag purposes. And so there's not much overlap between current registered carbon farming projects and irrigated or intensive ag production.
The ABC couldn't get more updated figures on the amount of ag land going into these kinds of projects. But Jane Hegarty from the New South Wales Farmers Branch in Cassilis says there are some big biodiversity projects in the area set up by mining companies, and the demand for more land to offset renewable energy projects is only going to increase.
In our district, we've got over 12,500 hectares purchased previously. Now, once you buy land and it goes into offset country that is supported by the Nature Conservation Trust, it is also exempt from local government rates. Now, that means that our local government is losing rateable money that could go towards repairing infrastructure for our community. And consequently, the more land they buy up, the less rates our Shire has to spend locally.
Is it a significant amount of land or farmland?
There's more and more land being purchased or set aside under Conservation Trust agreements in our community because of the renewable energy zone that is developing. So we don't know where it's going to stop. I mean, Central West Arana Res is only at stage one development. There is a proposed stage two and a proposed stage three. So we're only at the beginning of this. So how much agricultural land are we going to take out of agricultural production or food and farm production and put into offset country that is not really producing income for our state?
The New South Wales Farmers Association has adopted several new policies to deal with the problem, including a call for increased local government rates for mining and renewable companies' offset projects. They're also calling for a change to the way offset projects are zoned, so they have to go through normal development approval processes. Meanwhile, one landholder in the south of the state says the mining company Woodside is now the biggest landholder on the Monero. Monero farmer John Jeffries says the big polluters will have to spend about $2 billion to offset their emissions by 2030. But all that investment won't result in lower emissions.
Most of that $2 billion is either A, disappearing into fairy dust, into credits that don't actually exist, or B, disappearing into a lot of this new middle layer that has formed to facilitate these carbon projects and get a slice of that revenue.
Mr. Jeffries says New South Wales should introduce a cap on the percentage of a property that can be planted out, as they do in New Zealand.
We've seen 400,000 hectares of farmland in New Zealand disappear, and in New Zealand that's a pretty big deal because there's not much of it to start with. But this is having significant negative impacts and environmental excess with whole of landscapes sort of planted out to largely pine trees for carbon offset. So by bringing this 25% limit in, all of a sudden that focuses that investment and that market for tree planting per se into integrated land use in amongst farmlands, because these big entities do not really want to buy farmland and actually have to do something with 75% of it. That's not in their mantra. Most of these large land acquisitions are sort of plant and leave type models. Shut the gate, walk away, claim the credits. Lots of money flying around. In fact, in New Zealand, their highest returning land use is carbon forestry. They're turning over in excess of $3,000 a hectare. The problem is most of that revenue is washing around far away from the communities they impact.
Monero farmer John Jeffries ending that report from David Claughton. Agriculture, construction, energy mining, carbon sequestration and environmental offsets. All of these industries want access to Australia's land and water. But how can these different interests be managed? The Australian Farm Institute has published a 124-page journal that zeroes in on the growing demand for Australia's land. Executive Director Katie McRoberts says while there's always been demand for land, the scale and source of those demands have changed.
Now, sometimes this is framed as land use competition. It's not always about competition. A lot of times it can be about collaboration and coexistence. Sometimes it is about direct competition, but who is making those decisions and what those decisions mean, not just for our present, but for our future, our productive future, is where the AFI has been very interested, and there's obviously still plenty of work to do.
How can some of those competing interests or similar interests, I guess, how can they be managed? Have you found some examples where different parties have worked together in using the land?
There are some really good examples. So one thing that has been a source of some very strong tensions in farming communities, very legitimate tensions, is what is seen as direct competition from energy providers and energy infrastructure, for example. Now, it doesn't always have to be an either-or discussion. It's not always about taking land out of farming and putting it under concrete. There are ways that coexistence can be managed as long as it's a very place-based collaborative approach for what is right for the people in those communities. And a really good example of this in the journal is from the Wimmera Southern Mallee. So we've had the two people who've co-authored a piece there, Chris Saunas from the Wimmera Farmers Group and Sabine Heindel from the Energy Charter. And they talk about an agri-energy framing, which positions cheaper and more reliable energy as an input to strengthen the agricultural businesses operating alongside it rather than it being an either or. This is not necessarily an easy thing to do, but it's a really important thing to do. We do need energy infrastructure updated in Australia. We do need alternative forms of energy for a low carbon and sustainable future. We also need to consider what our agricultural productive capability looks like alongside that, and framing it as oppositional can be a really destructive thing to do. We all recognise it's not easy, but that example from the Wimmera Southern Mallee where the community there has found an approach that works for them is a really good case study for others to consider.
So when it comes to managing interest in the land, does Australia need something like a national land use framework? Is this something that has been done in other countries?
A national land use framework would be really useful, but maybe a somewhat optimistic thing to aim for. That doesn't mean we shouldn't aim for it. But a lot of the issues that come through in land use planning tensions and land use decisions are at that either state or regional level rather than a national level. So any kind of national framework would obviously have to be principles-based, much like the Australian Agricultural Sustainability Framework is a principles-based approach to saying, here are the common goals we're all aiming for. We all want healthy water supplies. We all want great soil to grow things in. How are we going to work towards that together from a regional perspective? The same way for a national land use framework, we would have to consider all of those different place-based and highly regional and agroecological approaches. So no one's suggesting that we need a nationally applicable set of rules that would be put in place, because what happens in Tasmania is very different to North Queensland, very different to Southwest WA. There is no one set of rules that works for everybody, but some overarching guiding principles of what we want to see and how we would like to see our land used for our sustainable and productive future would be really important. Has that been done in other places? Great question. There's also another interesting paper in this journal written by some Nuffield scholars, and these are people who call home UK, Zimbabwe and Australia. And they do bring some really interesting examples there from the UK experience and from the Zimbabwean perspective. They also propose that those decisions need to really be assessed about whether they constrain future options for stability and for viability and for adaptability, whether you're locking in things that you don't want to see stuck in place for the next 50 years.
Katie McRobert is the Executive Director of the Australian Farm Institute. She was speaking there to Fiona Broom. Getting some texts on the rain, as I said before. Barney's texted in from Batlow saying the bird flu is an enormously serious issue. Doesn't appear the government has done as much as possible to prepare. He talks about building some large aviaries in inland centres like Batlow to protect threatened bird species. So that's Barney's idea. He also says that Batlow has had about 80 millimetres of rain in the last 24 hours, so he's pretty happy with that one as well. Some other people letting us know about rain, 7.8 millimetres in Yass over the last 24 hours, so some welcome rain there. And, yeah, some other texts about the bananas as well. We'll get a little bit more about that shortly. We'll have the rainfall and the weather from the Bureau shortly as well. But before we do anything else, we should get some news headlines with Adam Story. Good afternoon.
Afternoon, Michael. Corrections officers in several of the state's prisons have walked off the job this morning and they're not expected to return till 7 tomorrow. The Public Service Association says the strike was triggered after a prisoner was released on bail yesterday who had allegedly assaulted a corrections officer last week. Now, it says prisoners will be locked in their cells, as is the standard procedure during strikes, and also court procedures involving inmates are also expected to be impacted. The Prime Minister will use a speech tonight to give more details about the proposed national standards for new AI data centres. He'll tell the Business Council dinner the legislated standards for larger data centres will focus on location along with energy and water. The Prime Minister is still facing pushback from Queensland over the and the Northern Territory over the standards requiring that these centres use renewable energy only. And it came out, it comes as the Australian Energy Market Operator said today that the data centres that are currently already are in operation are already pulling about 3% of power out of the grid, with more to come. Meanwhile, the Prime Minister says he's not expecting backlash from other state and territory leaders over his promise not to alter the GST distribution scheme. He announced yesterday the scheme won't change under his leadership, despite a report by the Productivity Commission recommending that it was a bad deal and a return to the previous scheme. Under this current deal, it basically guarantees WA won't receive anything less than 75% than what it would get if the GST was divided up based on population. And the Red Cross has issued another urgent call for thousands of blood donations, with supplies down by up to 30%. That's due to winter coughs and colds preventing many regular donors from donating. Red Cross Lifeblood says almost 6,000 donations for O-type blood alone are needed in the coming 7 days.
Right. So if you're well enough, go and
donate.
Well
enough, yep.
Yeah.
Roll it up.
Off you go.
I think you get a free cookie and a something, don't you?
Yeah, and a cup of tea.
Cup of tea. Yep.
All right. Okay, well, I'll let you head off to the nearest donor centre in the next 25 minutes.
Thanks, mate. I don't know who'd want mine.
Well, we won't go there.
Yeah.
It's 24 minutes to one here on the New South Wales Country Hour. Let's find out what's happening with the weather details and Sean Parks at the Bureau. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael.
So some good rain around the place. We're getting some, Cootamundra, nearly 40 millimetres there, 80 millimetres at Batlow. It's still raining in many parts. Is it mainly in the south?
Actually, for much of the state, but again, this morning the focus of the rainfall was certainly on the southwest slopes and alpine ranges and the far southern inland plains. But we expect the focus of rainfall to spread to much of the central and northern inland and western slopes and into the ranges. While the main center of the rain band shifted northeastward, and then by this evening and overnight, the focus of rainfall will be shifting north towards the northwest slopes and plains as well as New England regions before easing to scattered showers. So with that, for those areas on and west of the ranges, we'll generally expect, say, 10 to 30 millimeters of rainfall, as I said, and some regions already have received a lot more than that. And as you said, places like Batlow and Thredbo and Perisher has received more than 50 to 60 millimeters. And so with that, there was a history of severe weather warning for heavy rainfall for those elevated parts in the south, but that has been cancelled. But on the other hand, this rain event is still persisting, so much of the western slopes and the ranges and the inland plains, maybe except the far west, should receive good, at least something like 10 to 30 millimeters of rainfall. But on the other hand, this rain has already cleared in the state's far northwest corner. So for those areas, this event has already finished. Then, as this rain shifts to the northeast and easing to scatter the showers, we may still see some thunderstorms risk still lingering, and perhaps and the chance of thunderstorms may be increasing this afternoon across the inland plains and the western slopes, and possibly extending to the ranges this evening, and some thunderstorms may become severe this afternoon. So with that, damaging winds as well as heavy rainfall leading to flash flooding and large hailstones all possible if these severe thunderstorms come off. So if that happens, the Bureau will be issuing a severe thunderstorms warning. So please keep yourself up to date with these storm development this afternoon and the evening. Then tomorrow we expect the showers to still to remain for much of the eastern half of the state. And then after that, we expect generally dry and benign weather conditions to prevail from Thursday onward.
And so those here, we're talking about Coonamble and Dubbo and some Walgett. Are they still yet to get some rainfall, or that's been through that section?
Actually, the rain is and the showers are still persisting in those regions. So, you know, you may still expect another something like 10 millimeters over those areas at least, and possibly more. You know,
and then it'll be moving to Narrabri, Moree, Tamworth, Armidale from there.
Yeah, that's right. That's our anticipation. Yes.
Right, and that's similar sort of 10 to 20 millimeters for them as well.
Yeah,
maybe a little bit more if you're under a storm.
Yes, exactly, yes. That's our anticipation, yes.
Well, we'll have to wait and see. But it could be some wild weather as well, but we'll have to wait for some warnings. Not out yet, just yet.
That's right. At this moment, there's no storm warnings, but there is a potential to see active storms this afternoon. So, yes, if that happens, then, yeah, the Bureau will be issuing the warning.
So keep an eye out for the Bureau warnings. Yes. Thanks for that, Juan.
Yeah, my pleasure.
It's 19 minutes to one here on the New South Wales Country Hour. Well, with spring around the corner, farmers are starting to think about harvest, but also those relying on bee pollination. There could be some problems. Resistance to Armitraz, one of the two main chemicals used to treat varroa mite, was discovered in April, and the flow-on effects are continuing. Beekeepers are struggling not to just keep bees alive, but to keep up with the cost of treating their hives. The New South Wales Apiarist Association President Matthew Skinner addressed the media on Griffith yesterday, calling for more financial support from the New South Wales government and warning about potential effects on crops this season.
Almonds this year is starting to feel the impacts, and there's going to be other pollination-dependent industries going forward that haven't had to source bees before. They're going to see failed crops like in Bilpin last year with the apples. We see this being a roll-on effect, and we're trying to get the word out there for people that need some sort of pollination to be sourcing bees early, and also understanding the quality of the bees you need to be sourcing.
We're standing in this magnificent almond orchard. What other crops are at risk, Matt?
So the roll-on effect, we've got blueberries is another big one, cherry pollination, apple pollination, seed canola, and it could even go down to affecting clover and lucerne pollination, which will then affect livestock.
How critical is this issue for the Riverina food bowl?
We see this being very critical, especially for almond growers this year. Some growers have short on beehives, and there were some beekeepers out there that haven't come to almonds this year because they've dealt with the resistance to start with, and they're still trying to get their heads around that. So they're obviously got financial impacts of not coming to the almond pollination, but we just need to try and work out some system, whether it's treatments, so that beekeepers have got confidence to come to it again. Beekeepers are really feeling it financially, with labour, increased labour. So we've gone from a synthetic treatment, which could be 6 to 8 week duration, to weekly treatments now with organics.
You had a meeting with Agricultural Minister Tara Moriarty recently about this issue. Where did that lead and what was the outcome?
Trying to get the message out there, the impacts that we see this happening. Unless we can get some assistance financially or treatment subsidies to try and help beekeepers get through this initial stages and help beekeepers reset, get their numbers down so that they can work out a system going forward to try and maintain low levels. It's up to 35 to 40% of commercial beekeepers are losing faith in the industry and thinking about leaving the industry in 2 years' time. We have already seen some commercial operators leave, some of them being generational beekeepers. And once we lose those generational beekeepers, we're losing the knowledge that gets passed down. Beekeeping's not something you can learn overnight. It's years of working and understanding how it all, the floral and chasing different flora and fauna.
Now, varroa mite has led some farmers to experiment with alternatives, including self-pollinating plants, in an effort to stay viable. Dean DiNicola is farm manager of Mandol Orchard Almonds in the Riverina and spoke about self-pollinating almond trees as he's planted. While they still rely on bees, he's hoping in the future they won't need to.
So we've just put a new orchard in 2022. It's a 140 hectare farm, and it's all self-pollinating. So we're with that farm being kind of isolated without having bees on it. We'll hope to see some results over the next 10 years when we get to the mature age and seeing what the crops are, you know, what they will produce without having bees to pollinate the trees.
Mm. And this is very much a response in, you know, a worst-case scenario where things are heading at the moment, is that correct?
Correct, yes. We, you know, if it was all doom and gloom and there was no bees around and we had only self-pollinating almond trees, we would hope that they would still be able to produce fruit by themselves without the total reliance on bees. So we hope, you know, it'll work out. But, you know, while bees are still here with us, and if we do see that we're not getting the yields that we should be getting, then we will have to add bees into them. A lot of the corporate farms, they're putting in self-pollinators too now, just big blocks of them as well, because everybody's seeing the same thing with bees. There's going to be a big fight for them, and they're just not going to be affordable to have bees or the high numbers of bees in the orchards.
Dean Di Nicola speaking with Griffith reporter Nicola Saccato there. We're also waiting for a response from Tara Moriarty, the Minister, on the discussions and what came out of it with the beekeeping industry as well, the Apiarists Association. Getting some texts on a range of issues here. First of all, on the bananas, and this person has texted in making a link there between a person who had a service station and he stopped selling newspapers because there was no profit, and then the truckies and the regulars who bought fuel and coffee didn't come to that service station anymore, says Kay. So just a reminder there about locals and how they feel about those sorts of things. 13 millimetres of rain at Berrydale. This person saying that the guts fell out of it at Threadbow as usual before it got here, so that's why it was only 13 millimetres. On the bird flu, Jason says, wouldn't it be better to incinerate the dead birds if they're in landfill? Foxes, rats, etc. could eat them, and even other birds could access the infected carcasses. Well, that's why they tend to bury them on the farm, so they can't get to them. So bury them fairly deeply on the farm is what I understand they do at poultry farms, Jason, but I'll take your point there. Someone else has texted in on the offset issue, saying that they worked with offset properties of one of the major coal miners in New South Wales, and the properties they buy are often a bit of a mixture of top farmland and rougher ridge country. The problem is eventually they revegetate the whole property, rather than just revegetating the non-agricultural land. And this person's saying there should be a system where companies have to do a boundary readjustment, revegetate the rough country, and then sell the remaining agricultural country back to agriculture, or maybe farm it themselves. It's 13 minutes to one.
You're with Michael Condon for the New South Wales Country Hour on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today. Anthony Albanese faces further GST backlash after standing by a lucrative WA deal as a wedge opens between the Productivity Commission and the government. The US threatens severe sanctions against countries with economic ties to Iran. The big question is how China will now respond. And first it was marathon running. Now it's the 100-metre sprint, the dazzling displays of Beijing's high-tech robots on display at the Humanoid Games. Join me for The World Today.
But here on the country, there are 86 livestock sale yards around the country. 9 in 10 of those are council-owned, and in many cases the facilities are in decline. So what can be done to turn this around for our regional communities? Charles Boog is CEO of Signal 7. He's presented some analysis at the National Sale Yard Conference earlier this month, where he urged councils and sale yards to take a bit of a national approach.
What we've hit is we've hit a stage, and we've been hitting it for a while, but it's become probably a little bit more acute. Well, I'd say the first thing is that the sale yard network as a whole is probably stretched to the point now where it really can't get that much smaller. Secondly, yes, the big are getting bigger. That's consolidation. And with that comes the challenge that there are more trucks on the road and more livestock moving in transit. And the challenge with that is that you come up with increasing animal welfare issues. So whilst we want to make sure we have efficient movement of livestock through to sale yards, we have to be careful of the distance in which we transport them, because that affects the condition of the animals once they arrive, their weight, and ultimately the price that can be achieved for the sale of that animal.
What have you found when it comes to, I guess, the infrastructure or the investment that's needed to keep these sale yards up to standard?
Broadly across the sector, most sale yards, and I would exclude the privates from this because they do operate under their own commercial model, which allows them to, through the fees and charges that they operate, recoup enough for the recapitalisation of the investment. But throughout this, the sale yard sector more broadly and across the public sale yards, the operating models haven't really changed for the last 70 years. And so that means that the per head charge for throughput of animals really means there's never enough money every year to do more than recoup the costs of running the sale yard. There's not a lot of reinvestment that can occur because there's a cap on how much fees can be charged.
Do you think that needs to change?
Oh, without a doubt. I think in 2026, if a sale yard, which is effectively a commercial asset, is getting treated in the same way as the local community library and has to compete for funding in that way, then we're doing ourselves a disservice, if I could say that.
Do you think that there needs to be more, I guess, government money put into these livestock centres, or does it need to come from landholders themselves?
So it's interesting, that question. It's not so much about more funding from government. In the last 15 years, government spent probably over $350 million on that network in some form or another. The problem is they treat all those that spend as individual sale yards, and they don't get to see the bigger picture. But if we start to treat them as a joined-up network and what they can be and really should be treated as, then you can direct the same amount of money in terms of funding into the areas that would strengthen the network, that would give us the things like the biosecurity outcomes that we want, that would give us the national food security outcomes that we want. So it's more about spending the money in the right way and for sale yards to not to see themselves within that broader context and maybe change the type of sale yard that they are. That, I think, is the key. And that's probably the hardest thing for sale yards and councils more broadly. They're used to seeing these assets as community assets, but if they are treated as commercial assets where they understand they're going to get a return for the council, which means more money ultimately in the council's hands, then it does mean a different some sale yards will become different to what they are. The main point, I think, that I'd make to them is that the national recognition of sale yards benefits the whole industry. It means that you're going to have a more resilient and productive sector. Small farmers in particular will continue to get better access to markets and better prices because stock might not have to be transferred such long distances in some cases. I think from a council perspective, they need to learn to change their thinking around what a sale yard is. If the industry doesn't define the network, closures and the funding decisions will end up defining it for them, and you might not like what you get.
Charles Boog is CEO of Signal 7. He was speaking there about sale yards with Josh Becker. Talking about sale yards, let's go to Wodonga Cattle.
Good afternoon. Numbers declined slightly to 837. Just under half the offering were cows. Quality was very mixed. However, there were some outstanding trade cattle and heavy export steers in the mix. Cow quality was very good also, with very few leaner types. The usual buyers are at the market and most were operating. The top end of the veal jumped 13 cents, 512 to 556. Trade steers bounced 30 cents, 510 to 548. Feeder steers were up 50 cents on account of the quality and very few to quote, 514 to 547. Feeder heifers were back 20, 430 to 480. Trade heifers lifted 15 cents, 460 to 522. Heavy steers to soup processors were up 20 cents, 468 to $5. Bullocks also lifted 20, 435 to 492. Heavy heifer prices varied, 410 to 505. Heavy cows sold 5 cents better, 396 to 432. Leaner cows under 520 kilo were very few. 375 to 390, and good bulls, the heavy end, 415 to 447. Leanne Dax, MLA.
To Forbes Sheep and Lambs.
Good afternoon. Numbers fell this sale with agency yarding 31,200 head. Lamb numbers were back to 22,900 and quality continues to be mixed but fair. There was good numbers of trade and export lambs available along with those planar and secondary types more suitable to go back to the paddock. Most of the usual buyers are present competing in a firm to dearer market. There's 4,600 new season lambs penned and these trade weights sold from $288 to $325 a head. Old lambs were also $4 to $5 better, with trade weight 20 to 24 kilo ranging from $250 to $310 a head. Heavy lambs 24 to 26 kilo sold from $290 to $336, while those export lambs over 26 kilos ranged in price from $321 to a top of $400. Carcass prices averaged from $1092 to $1230 a kilo. The best heavy hoggart reached 315, and the balance of the lambs and 8,300 head of mutton are still to be sold. This has been Crystal Ridley at Forbes from LA.
To Carcor Cattle.
Good afternoon. Numbers eased by 490 for a total of 1,290 head. The quality was good with plenty of feeders, some with plenty of condition, a few more trade cattle and a small run of weaners. The grown steers and heifers remain in short supply and only 220 cows were penned. The weaner steers lifted 12 cents and reached 5.95. Heifers jumped 20, making to 5.25. Medium and heavy feeder steers were firm, 5.16 to 5.60, but steers around the 300 kilos were dearer and reached 5.76. Feeder heifers were firm to 5 cents easier, 4.80 to 5.30. The trade cattle lifted 10 cents, 4.80 to 5.13. Prime grown steers and bullocks lifted 15 and topped at 4.80. The heavy grown heifers gained 8, 4.55 to 4.69. Cows were 3 to 5 cents better. The prime heavyweights, 3.99 to 4.26. The leaner two scores, 3.69 to 3.78.
To Gunnedah Cattle.
1,200 cattle were scanned in Gunnedah this week, 720 less than last week. It was a fair quality yarding of predominantly yearling and weaner type cattle. Young cattle to the trade as well as prime grown cattle were limited. All major buyers were present for an overall dearer market. Prime cattle to the trade made to 420 cents a kilogram. Yearling steers to feed were considerably dearer to make from 480 to 598 cents and average 577 cents. Yearling heifers to feed improved by 10 cents and make 424 to 554 cents and average 528 cents a kilogram. Renewed interest in light cattle to the restocker continued to see rises of 40 cents or more in places. The steers made from 548 to 640 cents and averaged 600 cents a kilogram. The heifers made from 450 to 540 cents and averaged 500 cents a kilogram. Prime grown cattle to the processor topped at 422 cents. Two score cows to the processor were 25 cents dearer. They made from 300 to 350 cents. Three score cows held firm to make from 340 to 379 cents. Four score prime heavyweight cows were marginally cheaper to make from 380 to 400. And the best bulls got to 396 cents a kilogram. This is Hamish Hosgood in Gunnedah for MLA.
To Inverell Cattle now.
Good afternoon. 607 cattle penned in Inverell this week, 692 less than last sale. It was a mixed yarding with larger numbers of bulls penned and only 128 cows on offer, along with several pens of quality yearling steers and heifers to suit the feeder and restocker buyer. All the regular buyers attended and competed strongly, lifting prices across all classes. Yearling steers in the 200-80 range to restockers gained 24 and sold from 470 to 614. Medium weight yearling steers to feed sold from 464 to 594, up by 46. Heavy yearling steers to feed sold from 450 to 546. Light weight yearling heifers to background sold from 390 to 490, and medium weight yearling heifers to feed gained 50 and sold from 422 to 490. Heavy yearling heifers to processors sold at 485. Handful of grown steers to processors sold at 470. Lightweight plain condition cows to restockers sold from 300 to 380. Heavy score 2 cows to processors sold from 320 to 360. Good heavy cows lifted by 11 and sold from 371 to 388. Heavy bulls to processors dearer selling from 338 to 418. This has been Aeroluck, MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
And finally to Scone Cattle.
Good afternoon. Numbers up by 200 head saw Scone Agents Yard 665 cattle. Buyer enthusiasm was stronger as supported by positive short-term rain forecasts. Light steer calves under 200 kilos topped at 640 cents. Those between 200 and 280 kilos sold in a range of 495 to 632 cents to be 13 cents a kilo dearer, and they averaged around 568 cents. Light heifer calves also 13 cents a kilo dearer and more in places, with bigger lines of one mark pens selling from 458 to 548 to average around 518. Medium weight yearling feeder steers sold a strong competition to be 53 cents a kilo better off, 478 to 570. Heavier types over 400 kilos saw similar gains, and they sold from 460 to 526. Medium weight yearling heifers to feed on, 480 to 528 to be 23 cents a kilo dearer. Prime grain-assisted yearlings to the local trade sold from 532 to 544. Around 60 cows offered, two scores substantially dearer, 210 to 330. Heavy 3 and 4 scores, 2 to 9 cents kilo and positive, selling from 366 to 402 cents. Angus Barlow for MLA at Scone.
You've been listening to the New South Wales Country. On the rainfall, Robin at Bega says they've had 6 drops of rain. And as I said before, 13 millimetres at Berrydale. They say that all the rain fell at Threadbow before it got to them. You're listening to the Country Hour. It's heading up to news time.